You're listening to KRUU LP 100.1 FM, the voices of Fairfield, Iowa, and beyond, grassroots listener-supported, solar-powered radio broadcasting live from the Cultural District in sunny Fairfield, Iowa, on this beautiful September afternoon.
Wow, yeah. September 11th.
September 11th.
Yep, that anniversary of that horrible day.
Yep. And this is Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I am your host, Monica Hadley. With me is my co-host and mom, Caroline Kilborn. Hi, Mom.
Hi. beautiful day. Oh, gosh.
And Writers' Voices is broadcast on Fridays at 1 p.m. and rebroadcast Monday mornings at 8 a.m. So if you miss this or if you hear it, and tell all your friends, because we have a great show today.
Oh, we do. This, yeah, I'll say.
So who do we have today, Mom?
Today we have Daniel James Brown, and he's the author of The Boys in the Boat, which is a historical piece, and a little bit about his background. He grew up in San Francisco Bay Area and attended Diablo Valley College, the University of California at Berkeley, and UCLA. He taught writing at San Jose State University and Stanford before becoming a technical writer and editor. He now writes narrative nonfiction books full-time. His primary interest as a writer is in bringing compelling historical events to life as vividly and accurately as he can, and he certainly did that.
He certainly does. Yes. The Boys in the Boat, that describes it to a T. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Daniel.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So is this your third book, The Boys in the Boat?
Yes, this is book number three.
So tell us how you came to write this particular book.
This story, it literally walked into my home one day about 7 years ago. My neighbor came to me, and she said that she'd been reading one of my earlier books to her father. He was living under hospice care at her home, and he was in the last couple of months of his life. But he was enjoying that book, and he had asked to meet me. So I went down, I think it was the next day, to her house, and I met this elderly gentleman named Joe Rance. And Joe was, he was weak, he was on oxygen, but he was very alert mentally, stretched out on a recliner. So I sat down next to Joe, and we talked only very briefly, actually, about that earlier book. And then he began to talk about his experiences as a child and adolescent growing up during the Great Depression. And he had a particularly heart-rending and heart-touching story about his personal circumstances and his family situation during the Depression. And that in itself really got to me. But then he began to talk about how he and there's a bunch of boys had come together at the University of Washington starting in the fall of 1933 and become arguably the greatest collegiate crew of all time, and wound up rowing for an Olympic gold medal in Berlin in 1936 against a German boat in front of Adolf Hitler. And
yes.
As Joe was telling me this story, I just became absolutely mesmerized by it. And so the book really all flowed out of that first conversation with Joe.
Wow.
Wasn't that wonderful that you were able to meet him personally and talk to him? That was great.
Yeah, it was just pure happenstance.
Yeah.
And had you any awareness of this event prior to that?
No, I had no awareness at all. You know, it's a story that it was quite big in Seattle at the time, and it actually was quite big in the national newspapers at the time. The Jesse Owens story, which happened just a few days earlier, sort of eclipsed it to some extent.
Mm-hmm.
But it sort of fell out of view. These guys came back from Berlin that summer, and there wasn't a big ticker tape parade or anything like that. They put their gold medals in sock drawers and went out and tried to find a job to get through another year of school. So the story sort of faded away from memory. When I started it, there were a few people of a certain age in Seattle that remembered it, but not many.
Wow.
I'll bet it didn't fade in Hitler's memory, though.
No, you know, we don't know exactly how Hitler reacted. There is some grainy footage of him watching the races. Germany won the first five rowing events that day, won gold medals, five straight gold medals, leading up to the big prestige event, which is the Eight-Ord race. And there's some grainy footage of Hitler and Goebbels and Goering up on the balcony of his boathouse from which they watched the races, slapping each other on the back and pumping their fists and jumping up and down as the Germans won these medals. But all we know about Hitler's reaction to the ultimate American victory in the big race was he and his entourage just sort of turned around, disappeared from the balcony, and we don't see any more of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, that's not surprising. And they didn't exactly play fair in terms of
the start
or yeah. giving, or lane position, did they?
Oh, and one of the amazing things about the story is that in the qualifying heats for the medal round of the races, the U.S. and Great Britain actually turned in the two fastest qualifying times. Germany and Italy, the two fascist states, turned in relatively slow qualifying times. But when the final lane assignments were made, the U.S. and Great Britain were placed in lanes 5 and 6 out in the windiest part of the race course.
Mm-hmm.
And Italy and Germany were placed in lanes 1 and 2, which were sheltered from the wind virtually the whole length of the race course. So that was not the usual practice. Ordinarily, the faster competitors would have had the preferred lane assignments. So it was kind of fishy, and it was a definite handicap for both the American and the British boat.
Tell us, Daniel, a little bit about the earlier books that you wrote, and how you became a writer of this type of book.
Sure. I started writing this kind of book when about 15 years ago. I got into a box of stuff. I was helping my mother move from California up to Washington, and I got into a box of stuff from her attic and began to read about this calamitous forest fire in Minnesota in 1894. And I knew that my great-grandfather had died in that fire, but I really didn't know much more than that about it. And there were diaries and some old books and some news clippings and some photographs. And I just became absolutely intrigued by that event. And so I, without having an agent or an editor or anything, I sat down and wrote the book, just flat out wrote the, I mean, it took a couple years to write. I did a lot of research, but I wrote the book first and then went out to see if I could sell it. And it took a while, but eventually I got an agent and an editor, and so that was my first book. And then I was very lucky because Barnes & Noble has a thing called Discover Great New Writers, and they picked that book as one of their picks, which meant they put it in a rack up in the front of the store. And that caused HarperCollins to take an interest in it, and they published the paperback.
Mm.
And then my second book...
and the title of that book...
Oh, I'm sorry. That's called Under a Flaming Sky, The Great Hinckley Firestorm of 1894. It's quite an amazing thing. There were a lot of amazingly heroic actions that day.
And how is that book centered? Like in The Boys in the Boat, you focus on one of the boys in the boat primarily, which is the man that you met, Joe Rotz. With Under a Flaming Sky, was the main character your grandfather?
Yes. Well, actually, so my great-grandfather died, but my grandfather and his mother, my great-grandmother, survived. They actually climbed on a train that was wound up on fire from one end to another, and they had to jump off the train and immerse themselves in a swamp, and there was this whole very harrowing experience they had. So I grew up with some stories about my grandfather's experience in that event, although not a lot. And so, yes, I focused the narrative primarily on their family, my family. But there were so many other interesting family stories that had been collected over the years that I pulled quite a few other families into the story, too.
Wow. Okay. And so from that success, you went on to...
And so then the next book I wrote is called The Indifferent Stars Above, The Harrowing Saga of a Donner Party Bride. I also had a sort of tangential family relationship with the Donner Party disaster in 1846. That was the wagon train party that got snowbound in the Sierra Nevada that winter, and terrible things happened. They began to starve, and there was some cannibalism and all that. My great uncle led the first rescue expedition up into the mountains to reach the Donner Party and bring survivors out. And so I had grown up seeing his diary and knowing quite a bit about the story. But I wound up focusing not on my family, but on a young woman named Sarah Graves, about whom nobody really had written. She was 21 the year that the Donner Party set out, and she was basically on her honeymoon. She got married just before they left. And they fell into this disastrous situation in the mountains. But Sarah was one of a handful of relatively young, healthy people that tried to hike out of the mountains to get word to the outside world of what was happening. And she actually succeeded. Of the 15 that started out, only 5 made it through to get word out, but Sarah was one of those. So I focused the story on her. She was quite a remarkable young woman.
And how were you able to learn about her?
Well, the Donner Party, of course, so much has been written about it, so there are a lot of already published materials. And then I spent a lot of time in the archives in Sacramento and at UC Berkeley, where a lot of the Donner Party papers are kept. I connected with some of Sarah's descendants who had photographs of her and also various bits of family information. So it was it was one of these big research projects of piecing small bits of information together and constructing the larger narrative out of it.
Now, our guest last week, who was Michelle Gable, the author of A Paris Apartment, also did a lot of historical research for her book, but then put it, even though it was based on a true story, put it in a fictional form. Did you ever consider going that way? And if you did, why do you choose to stick with the nonfiction format?
Yeah, I like the discipline of sticking with the facts. And there's always a temptation, of course, when you're writing something like this, to fictionalize it and just say, okay, this is a novel, because I could make it so much more compelling in this place or that place if I altered the facts. But I like the discipline of having to work within the facts. And it's always a huge challenge, especially when you're writing about something that happened a long time ago. In the case of his most recent book, The Boys in the Boat, I was very lucky because, as I say, Joe Rance is sort of the central character. And Joe only lived 2 months after I first met him. But his daughter, Judy, had spent about the last 5 years following him around with a pad of paper and pencil, asking him just all kinds of very, very detailed questions about his experience growing up during the Great Depression and his experiences on crew. So even after Joe passed away, we had very, very detailed information. So I could really get inside his head and understand what he was thinking. And then with the other 8 guys in the boat, again, I was very lucky because the families of all 8 of these fellows came to me with diaries and letters and all kinds of sources that I could use in order to develop them as well.
Oh, so you were able to research all of them, all 8 of them?
Yes, to varying degrees. I had much more on Joe than on the others. I had relatively little on Don Hume, one of these guys. But so I just had to adjust. I could spend more time on some of them than others. But I would have picked Joe as the center of the story anyway. Joe's personal story was so very, very compelling because of the obstacles that he overcame as a child and a young man. So he would have been the natural person to focus the story on anyway.
I wonder if you were ever tempted to use another one of the characters as your focal character, but I think you're right. His story is really gripping.
It is, and it's also, I think, in many ways representative of what so many people in that generation went through. I mean, his story was particularly challenging, I suppose, because he wound up literally having to forage in the woods for berries and mushrooms in order to feed himself. But in many ways, he's a good stand-in or a good representative for so many people who experienced so much privation during the Great Depression and had to overcome all kinds of obstacles. So I think for that reason, for me, he's a kind of representative of the whole generation.
You're listening to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline, and Our guest today is Daniel James Brown, author of The Boys in the Boat, the true story of an American team's epic journey to win gold at the 1936 Olympics. And this was, you probably wouldn't remember this event, would you, Mom?
Probably not. I was a year old. But it was interesting, too, that you recounted that before the Olympics, the Germans took down all of their signs against the Jews and so forth and made Germany seem very welcoming. And then as soon as they were over, it went right back to where it was before. And I wasn't surprised at that, but I'm glad that you mentioned that, because that was, you know, that was true. And it was quite a time, quite a time.
And were any of the boys in the boat Jewish?
Well, it turned out that one of them was, although he didn't know that until just before they left for Nazi Germany.
Oh.
Bobby Mock, the coxswain. The coxswain is the smaller person who sits at the back of the boat and steers the boat and also takes command of the boat. Bobby Mock, when they were in New York getting ready to go over to Berlin as Team USA, knew he had relatives in Germany, and so he wrote to his father back in Washington State and asked him to send some addresses so that he could visit them when he was over in Europe. And what he got back was he got back an envelope that had another envelope inside it, and it said, "Read this in a private place." So Bob took this envelope out and sat under an apple tree, actually, in a field, and opened it, and he read it, and he learned for the first time that his entire family heritage and history was Jewish. And he was thunderstruck by this, and he shed tears over it. He was so upset, not at discovering that he was Jewish, but he was horrified that his father had felt it necessary in America to conceal that from the larger world and even from his own family. So at any rate, Bob went to Germany just fresh with that realization.
Wow, that would be quite a thing to learn in that day and age, wouldn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we forget there was a lot of anti-Semitism in the United States in the 20s and 30s, and it held people back in their careers and their professional lives and their social lives if they were Jewish in certain circles, and I suppose that is what Bob Mock's dad was thinking. But as I say, it really upset Bob that he had had to do that, or felt he had to do that.
Now, did you go and visit the different locations, the different race courses that you write about?
Yeah, I'm kind of a fanatic about visiting every place that I write about. I find that I can pick up so many little details of just sounds and sights and textures, and even 75 years later, you learn a lot by being in the same place that events unfolded. And so I went to Poughkeepsie, New York, where the big national championship race was every year. I went out onto the Olympic Peninsula, where Joe grew up in the woods. I went out to the Grand Coulee Dam, where he worked during one summer. And, of course, I went to Berlin, and I went to the race course there, which is still there and looks very much as it did in 1936. And that was really helpful in all those cases. I was able to get a sense of the place and as I say, pick up a lot of helpful, small but very helpful details.
How important is the actual boat or the shell?
So the shell is very important, and in the days I'm writing about, everybody was rowing in wooden shells. And the best of those wooden shells were made of Western red cedar at the University of Washington by this master boat builder named George Yeoman Pocock. And Pocock was the consummate craftsman. I mean, these shells were and still are today just absolutely gorgeous things. But they were also state-of-the-art. By the mid-1930s, every rowing program in the country had Pocock shells and wanted more Pocock shells. They were the fastest.
Oh, shoot.
And so they were, you know, they were a big advantage. When the Americans went to Berlin, the Germans also had a very good boat. But having a freshly built Pocock shell was a definitely a good thing.
Pocock actually had quite an influence on Joe, didn't he?
Yeah, and that's the other thing about George Pocock. He was this master boat builder. As I say, he was a great craftsman. He approached building boats as a craft. But the important thing about him, really, is that he was also a very good rower. And he mentored many of these boys in rowing. And he taught them to approach their rowing the same way he approached his craft of building boats, to think of it as a craft they were practicing. And he taught them that if they practiced their craft and took great pride in what they were doing, they would lift themselves up and make themselves part of something more important than just an athletic competition. That had a huge effect on a lot of these guys, particularly on Joe Rance, who was kind of a lost soul and trying to figure out how to fit in and what the rowing business was all about. George took Joe aside up in his workshop and sat down with him a number of times and had very heartfelt conversations that helped Joe a lot.
Now, is that shell, that boat, still in existence?
Yeah, so that shell was called the Husky Clipper, and it is a beautiful thing. It is now hanging in the current University of Washington shell house. They have it hanging from the ceiling in the dining commons where the athletes all eat, and they have spotlights trained on it. It's been restored and refinished, and it's kind of a trophy for the university, but it's also just a really beautiful thing to behold. It's almost a work of art.
Yeah.
Daniel, did you know anything about crew when you started writing this book?
No. You know, the day after I met Joe Rance and committed to writing this book, really, I realized that this is a sport I didn't do and I didn't know anything about at all. And I was very nervous about that right from day one. So I made a point immediately of reaching out. And fortunately, the current rowing folks down at the Washington Shell House were very interested in what I was doing because this story is part of their history.
Mm.
So they put me in contact with their coaches and their best rowers. And then through those folks, I met a number of Olympic caliber rowers, and they took me out in the launch and taught me the basic parts of stroke. And so it took a while, but over a couple of years, I gradually got to understand sport on, I think, a pretty complete and deep level.
You really do your research.
I do.
I guess.
I like research. For me, I like the writing part, too. But one of the reasons I like to write these nonfiction historical narratives is that you learn so much by doing them. You wind up doing so much research into so many interesting and diverse different topics that you probably would never touch otherwise, that at the end of the process, you just come away knowing a lot about a lot of really interesting stuff.
I imagine that you do a lot of your research on the Internet.
Yeah, you know, I do. The Internet has become a hugely helpful resource for writers, particularly, I think, nonfiction writers like myself who need a lot of factual material to work with. And some of the stuff that's most valuable is actually very small, granular bits of information. So, for instance, if I want to write about a race scene in Poughkeepsie, New York, that took place late in the day under certain weather conditions, I can now go and I can find out on that day in Poughkeepsie, New York, all kinds of what time the sun came up, what time
Whoa.
The sun went down, what phase the moon was in, you know, what the mean temperature was, just all kinds of little details. And I can find photographs taken, you know, that day in Poughkeepsie without having to go to the archives in Poughkeepsie to find those photographs, and so on and so forth. So it's just a hugely valuable resource for, as I say, particularly for the kind of thing I do, which is built on bringing together a lot of details in order to create a scene.
So who puts on the weather details from 80 years ago on the internet?
So weather information is, it's not all concentrated in one place. Sometimes you do have to search. But in those days, a lot of the weather information was kept by local co-ops, they called them, weather service co-ops. And it's not always online, but more and more of it has been digitized and put online. So you're actually looking at images of logbooks that were written, you know, in 1935 or whatever. And you can simply page through those online and find out not only, for instance, in Seattle, there were four or five of these weather stations. And so you can see what weather was like in different parts of town on that same day. It's just amazing.
I know. It is very cool. I was working on a chapter in a book recently, and I wanted to know what color a car would have been in 1936.
Yeah.
And I was able to find all the paint colors of certain, and the models that were available and what colors were. It was very cool.
I'm not sure I could write a book like this, you know. I mean, even if it is, it took like 4 years to research and write this book, but I think it would have taken 10 years without the internet. It really does help.
Oh, yeah. Now, one thing that I noticed is that there's only like three major races that these boys were in each year, and they trained for months and months and months, all the entire school year, essentially. But there were only three races.
Well, yeah, there was a national championship race each year. They had some intercollegiate races each spring also, but you're right. There's very relatively few actual races given the months and months and months of training. And part of what's interesting about that is that because of that, each race was very high stakes. You know, it wasn't like a baseball season where you can lose a few games in a row and it's all right because you'll make it up later in the season.
Yeah.
Every time they went out on the water, they really needed to win, and the competitors did too. So the races were always very high stakes.
Wow. And why, you know, for most of these boys, they weren't upper class, they were middle class, working class. Why crew?
You know, for part of, you're right. First of all, they were very much working class. These were kids that grew up in mill towns and on dairy farms for the most part, or worked in shipyards in Seattle. And so they were, you know, they weren't like the kids they would wind up having to row against in the East, kids who had learned to row in prep school. But in terms of why crew, partly I think it was just they had the right temperament and the right physical build to be oarsmen. There's certain things rowing coaches look for, and one of them is a big, tall fellow with good upper body strength, and so on and so forth. And then they also look closely at the kind of temperament that the young man or young woman has, because you have to, at the one hand, you have to be audacious enough to go out and believe you can do this and have a fairly big ego, but on the other hand, you have to know how to fit in with other people. So that's part of the sort of difficult combination of personality types that rowing coaches look for. These particular nine guys, I mean, they were the end product of a selection process that whittled several hundred kids down to the nine who actually went to Berlin. They were just the ones that had those, you know, combinations of qualities.
And it surprised me that so many young men went out for crew when they had no experience with it in high school or, you know, why, that's, you know, what was it that drew them, so many of them, to try out for this?
I think it's partly, it was just a really big deal. We think of it now as a niche sport, but really in the 1920s and 30s and into the 40s, collegiate crew was a huge deal. I mean, it competed with collegiate football and with Major League Baseball for the number of fans who followed the sport. These regattas on Saturday afternoon, 80, 90, 100,000 people would turn out to watch a crew race. Crew races were broadcast sometimes live coast to coast on radio, which was then a brand new medium. A coxswain's sore throat could make headlines. it was a big deal. And so I suppose, in terms of being a student on the campus at Washington or anywhere else, it was a way to stand out, to be a prominent person on the campus, because the crews really were so celebrated then.
Is there anywhere in the world where crew is that popular now, where you'd get 100,000 people out for a race?
Well, they get 100,000 people out every fall in Boston for the head of the Charles, which is a huge rowing event. But I think that's, the only time 100,000 people get together anymore for a for a rowing event. It's more typical for a rowing event between, say, California and Washington for maybe 5,000 people to turn out and watch a race.
Now, here in Iowa, we don't have a lot of crew teams. And my daughter grew up here, small town, went to the University of Texas, freshman year, joined the crew team.
Yeah. one of the things I've been really surprised by is how many places people do find some water to row on. I've been all over the country talking about this book, and I have discovered that there are both collegiate rowing programs and also club rowing in the most improbable places, in Arizona and Kansas. I went to a reading event for the book in Wichita about a year ago, and I thought, oh God, bookstore is going to be empty. There won't be anybody there. At that time, it was mostly rowers that were reading the book. It's really broadened out since then. But actually, I went to Wichita, and I walked in that bookstore, and it was just overflowing with people. It turns out there's 3 or 4 rowing clubs in Wichita.
Wow.
You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline, and our guest today is Daniel James Brown, the author of The Boys in the Boat, the true story of an American team's epic journey to win gold at the 1936 Olympics. When was The Boys in the Boat originally published?
Well, the full version, the adult edition, was published in June of 2013, I think, so a couple of years ago. And then we just published the Young Readers adaptation 3 days ago.
And that's the version that we're talking about today, the one that we were able to read. Why a different version, and how did that process work in creating the young adult version?
Well, since the adult version came out a couple years ago, I just get a steady stream of email from folks, of course. And there's certain things that come up over and over. And one of the things that's been very prominent is we've been just getting lots and lots of email from parents and grandparents and teachers and librarians saying, wow, this book has such interesting slices of history and it has such great life lessons. I would really like my 10-year-old or my 11-year-old or 12-year-old to be able to read it for himself or herself. But it's just a little much for that age. So basically, that was what we were doing, was responding to that need, and we will see how it does. But I'm pretty optimistic. I get a lot of young people. When the book first came out, my audiences at readings were almost all notably old, and they've gotten younger as the time has gone on, and the book seems to be getting more and more popular among younger people, including kids. I have kids who've come up to me, and somebody has read the adult version, or they're just precocious readers, and they've read it themselves, and they're inspired by it, and they apply it to whatever they happen to be doing, trying to get on the basketball team or trying to make first violin in the orchestra or whatever it is that they're doing. So that's just been really cool.
How is the Young Reader edition different?
Well, first of all, it's shorter. We cut it down substantially. We divided it into many more shorter chapters. We simplified the language a little bit, although we really didn't dumb it down. We just tried to make language choices that were more appropriate for the age group. The stuff we took out was mostly the more esoteric stuff, some stuff about the fine details of a rowing stroke and socioeconomic events leading up to the Great Depression and things like that. We left enough of the history in there because we really wanted kids to be exposed to the history, but we didn't want to overdo that. So we took that kind of material out. And then the other thing we did is we added a lot of graphic elements. We added photographs, additional photographs beyond what were already in the book. We added a timeline because there's several strands to the story, so we added a timeline to help kids keep track of the different strands. We added a photo gallery of all the main characters in the book so kids could attach names to faces and keep track of who was who. We added a diagram of a rowing shell so that rather than a long discussion about the parts of a boat and all that, they can simply look at an illustration to see how a eight-oared rowing shell works. And so things like that. We added visual elements, basically.
Mm. And did you do this yourself, or did you have a co-writer?
It was sort of collaborative. My publisher and I agreed that we should have an experienced young readers author take the first cut at the manuscript. So a very nice young man named Greg Monet did a terrific job at sort of cutting it down to size and making a lot of the reading level decisions for me that I wasn't really sure about because I didn't have that kind of experience. But then, and when he had finished that, then I went through and I put my own stamp on it. I went and enlivened certain scenes and made sure that it was very important to me that that the heart of the story, sort of the emotional impact, particularly of Joe Rance's story, and the heart of it remain intact. And so I worked to make sure that that happened, and then it worked out. Pretty well, I think.
You know, the drama, too, it during the race was that individual who was very, very ill.
Yeah, and yet, Don Hume, stroke oar, is very critical in the boat. He sets the rhythm that everybody else in the boat follows. And he had been ill with some kind of respiratory infection for weeks leading up to the races in Berlin. And the few days before the big gold medal race, Don was just very, very sick. He was running a high fever. He was in bed. And Coach Al Ulbrichsen didn't think he'd be able to row. The night before the medal race, the other guys came to Coach Ulbrichsen, and they basically demanded that Don be allowed to row, even though he was sick. So Ulbrichsen finally relented and put Hume in the boat. But boy, he was one sick kid when he climbed into that boat, and it's just absolutely amazing that he managed to not only row the whole race, but actually win it.
Well, Daniel, why don't you read a section from The Boys in the Boat for us?
Okay. I'll read a little section here. This is fairly early in the book, and this is the young reader's edition of the book, but it's about the point in the story at which Joe has been working, Joe and his buddy Roger Morris, his first good friend on the crew, have been working all fall to try to make it into either the first boat or the second boat, one of the two boats that will be allowed to continue to varsity status the next year. And they're standing around waiting to see whether or not they're going to make the cut. And I'll read a passage from what that was like from their point of view. Finally, Coach Bowles emerged from the office and climbed up onto a bench, clutching a piece of paper. The boys shuffled into a semicircle around him. He began by saying that this selection was not final. All of them could continue to compete for seats he was about to announce. Nobody should get all swell-headed just because he heard his name called out now. Mm-hmm. Nobody should think he was a sure thing. There wasn't any such animal. Then he began to read off the names on the list. He moved first through the assignments for the second boat. When Coach Bowles finished, Joe glanced at Roger. His friend was staring morosely down at the floor. Neither of them had been called. Then Coach Bowles began calling out the first boat assignments. Bowsey, Roger Morris. Number 2, Shorty Hunt. Number 3 seat, Joe Rance. As Bowles continued, Joe clenched his fist at his side and gave it a little pump. Next to him, Roger began to exhale softly. As the rest of the boys headed for the showers, those selected for the first boat took a shell barge off its rack, hoisted it over their heads, and marched it down to the darkening lake for a celebratory row. A light but cutting wind ruffled the water. As the sun set, they began to row westward, seeking the calmer water of Lake Union. The temperatures had fallen into the upper 30s, and it felt even colder out on the water. But Joe hardly noticed. As the boat slipped onto the surface of Lake Union, the noise of the city traffic fell away, and he entered into a world completely silent, except for the rhythmic barking of the coxswain calling out their pace from the stern. Joe's seat slid methodically and silently back and forth on the greased runners beneath him. His arms and legs pulled and pushed smoothly, almost easily. When the white blades of his oar entered the black water, it did not splash. It just murmured. At the north end of the lake, the coxswain called out, "Way enough!" The boys stopped rowing. The shell glided to a stop, the long oars trailing in the water alongside them. The boys sat without talking, breathing heavily, exhaling plumes of white breath in the darkness. Even now that they had stopped rowing, their breathing was synchronized, and for a brief, fragile moment, it seemed to Joe as if all of them were part of a single thing, something alive with breath and spirit of its own. Joe gulped huge drafts of the frigid air and sat staring at the city lights in the distance, the amber lights of downtown, the ruby-red lights of radio towers, the green lights on docks along the shore. He watched the scene turn into a soft blur of colors as tears began to fill his eyes. For the first time since his family had left him, Joe began to cry. He turned his face to the water, fiddling with his oarlock so the others would not see. He didn't know where the tears had come from, or what they were all about. But something inside him had shifted, if only for a few moments. The boys caught their breaths, and they were talking softly, not joking for a change, not horsing around. Then the coxswain called out, "Ready all." Joe turned and faced the rear of his boat, slid his seat forward, sank the white blade of his oar into the oil-black water, tensed his muscles, and waited for the coxswain's next command, the one that would propel him forward into the darkness and into his future. And the coxswain called out again, "Row." That's it.
Yeah. Well, you know, in any team sport, there's a it's a supernatural thing, I think, when they're working together. But in football or something where they're all running here and there, it's different than in rowing. I would think that sense that they were working together and they have to, you know.
Yeah.
It's really magnificent, isn't it?
And that's really what that little scene was about. That was the first time Joe really realized and really felt a part of this thing that he was just beginning to become a part of, really. Rowing in one of these boats, rowing crew, is all about sort of letting go of the self a little bit,
mm-hmm.
and letting yourself become part of something bigger.
Yeah.
And that's really the beauty of it. It's why people who row get so very passionate about it. It's the communal experience, the sense of togetherness, and
right.
the sense of accomplishing something together that really is so so moving for them.
And it's interesting that that there wasn't more hoopla for them after they won in the Olympics.
Yeah,
that time.
You know, that was partly just a function of the fact that when they came back to Seattle after the Olympics, they didn't come back all at once, all together, for one thing. Some of them stayed in Europe to take a bicycle trip around Germany.
Oh.
Others had to come back quickly to get a job or something like that. So they came back in dribs and drabs. And
That makes a difference, yeah.
And the other thing was that the Jesse Owens story was so prominent that summer that it kind of dominated the headlines.
Mm-hmm.
And this story got a little bit buried because of that.
Yeah, well, explain that, because we have listeners, I know, that don't know what you're talking about.
So, yeah, so a couple of a week or so before the gold medal race that these fellows won, Jesse Owens, the African-American track and field star from Ohio, had gone to Berlin. And very impressively, he won 4 straight gold medals. And because he was African-American, and this was in front of Hitler, it was an enormous embarrassment to Hitler and his whole white supremacy theory of the world.
Right.
And it was a sensational story, both because of Jesse's extraordinary accomplishment and also because of the racial implications for the Nazis. And as I say, it just absolutely dominated newspaper coverage back here for over a week.
Oh, I can imagine. Yeah.
Now, Daniel, I just was looking at the New York Times bestseller list for print and ebook combined, and The Boys in the Boat has been on that list for 68 weeks.
Wow.
I didn't know exactly how many. I knew it was over a year. I didn't know the actual number of weeks.
Wow.
Yeah. So, and it's third this week, but it's been in the top 15 longer than any other book.
Yeah, it's just been a remarkable ride, and it's very heartening for me for a number of reasons. But one thing that's nice is it's been so much a word-of-mouth book. You know, we never got a New York Times review or any really large national media like the Today Show or something like that for this book. It's been mostly people talking about it to one another, taking it to their book clubs and things like that. And that's very gratifying because it means I know that people are enjoying it and it's on the list, not because of a lot of publicity, but because people are honestly enjoying it and sharing it.
Almost everyone that I mentioned that we were interviewing you today had heard of the book or had read the book or knew about the book.
That's great.
Yeah.
I need to get on airplanes lately and see them.
Oh, yeah.
I have several copies of the book as I'm walking down the aisle.
Do you ever stop and say, I wrote that?
I tell you, I sat down in a seat. And as I settled into my seat, the guy next to me reached under his seat and pulled out a copy of The Boys in the Boat and opened it. And I wasn't sure what to do. I noticed he was almost at the end of the book, so I say, well, he's read almost the whole thing, so he probably likes it.
Yeah.
I finally, after about 5 minutes of hemming and hawing, I tapped him and I said, you know, I could sign that book for you if you like. I'm the guy that wrote it. And then we got in a whole big conversation.
Oh, he must have been thrilled.
Yeah, his wife took a photo of us together and stuff like that.
That's
kind of cool.
And that'll probably happen more in the future, I imagine.
And I'm guessing that your previous books didn't get quite as much acclaim.
No, I mean, I think they did what they were expected to do, but nothing on this magnitude. No,
yeah.
As I say, that first book, Barnes & Noble chose it as a Discover Great New Writers book, and so that gave it a really nice launching pad. And the second book did just fine, but this book has just gone completely bonkers, a whole different level.
Wow. Well, congratulations.
Great.
You certainly worked for it.
Yes, absolutely.
it was a 4-year overnight success.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's work, but it's enjoyable work. I really do love the research part of it.
So what is next? What are you researching now?
Oh, you know, I've got 4 or 5 ideas that I'm looking into. Because writing one of these books does take 4 or 5 years of my life, it has to be something I really am passionate about. I don't want to spend 4 or 5 years on something that I'm not really interested in.
Yeah.
And so I'm getting kind of picky, and I'm taking my time looking at different ideas, trying to find one that I love as much as I love this one. A lot of stories have some of the elements I'm looking for, but it's very hard to find one that has all the elements, and so I'm still looking.
Wow. Well, if the hardcover was published 2 years ago, and I know the timeline between finishing writing and publishing, it's usually at least a year.
Yeah.
So it's three, I'm guessing about 3 years since you finished writing
that
The Boys in the Boat.
That sounds about right. And if I'd had my wits about me, I would have spent that intervening year finding the next topic. But I didn't. I was doing other things. So.
And then since it was published, has marketing been pretty much a full-time endeavor for you?
Yeah, I mean, and that's one reason that I haven't had time to really zero in on the next topic is that, basically I've been running around the country for 2 years talking to folks about the book, which I enjoy very much. There's so much positive energy out there. It keeps me energized to meet people and talk to them about the book. But it has been pretty much a full-time job. And so it's hard under those circumstances when you're constantly flying to a different city to settle down and think about what's next.
I think that's something that writers need to understand, that it's hard to make a living as a writer. And if you are fortunate enough to be able to do that, you're not going to be able to spend all your time writing.
Yeah, that is true. I mean, it is very much part of the job to get out there and talk about the book and meet people and show your appreciation for people that have appreciated your book. It's just, I don't understand writers that won't, get out and meet their readership, sign as many books as are put in front of them and so on and so forth.
Now, Daniel, when you're writing, do you have, do you do all the research and then start writing? Do you do it as you go?
Well, it's sort of two phases. I take a big cut at the research. So I spent probably the first year I was on this project doing nothing except researching. I basically just created a long timeline of events that might or might not work their way into the book. I tried to figure out everything that was relevant that was happening with Joe Rance and with the crew and with what was happening in America, what was happening in Nazi Germany for basically every day between 1933 and 1936. So I spent about a year just getting a sense of the big overall arc of the story and figuring out what elements needed to go in and which things didn't need to go in. And then I went back and I began with scene one in the book, and I write in what I think of as scenes, these chunks that are scenes. First scene in the book is Joe and Roger walking across campus and heading down to the shell house for the first day of crew practice in 1933. I go back and I identify what the first or what the next scene is going to be, but then I research that all over again, because once I know that's what I'm going to write about, I need to go find out things like, well, what was the weather like that day in Seattle? And are there pictures taken on the campus that day that will show me what students were dressing like? And what was in the news that day? And so on and so forth. So I go back and it's sort of iterative. I research each scene just before I write it. I write it, then I move on to the next scene and start the process over.
Mm. That does sound like a fascinating process, and keeps you engaged.
It does. It keeps me very engaged. My head was sort of, I think my family must have wondered where I was for a while. My head was in 1930.
So then, do you change much when you say you finish a couple three sections? Do you go back and change anything? Or
yeah. So what I do is, when I'm going to write one of those scenes, first of all, I wait until I'm so convinced, I can visualize everything I want to go in that scene, that when I sit down and write it, it usually comes out very quickly, because basically I'm writing it down because I'm afraid if I don't write it down, I will forget.
Uh-huh.
But then what I do is I take that scene and I put it in a drawer and move on to the next scene and the next scene after that. And I leave that first scene in the drawer for hopefully a few weeks before I come back to it and look at it again. And when I come back and look at it again, I always see things that could be better, things that should be taken out or things that should be added. And so, and then I start looping back through these scenes. I write new scenes. I go back and look at older scenes. I revise those. Then I move on. And so it becomes a very iterative kind of process. But I wind up at the end then with a manuscript that I've already done quite a bit of revision on before mm-hmm. I've ever actually put it all together as a manuscript. And then once I have put it all together, of course, I sit down and read the whole thing and make additional revisions now that I can see all the relationships between the parts.
Are you writing on the computer or on paper or both?
Entirely on the computer. My handwriting is so bad that even I can't read it, so it's useless.
How do you organize your research?
I'm sorry.
How do you organize your research?
Well, you know, I have to confess, I'm not sure anybody should emulate my process. It's very, very chaotic.
Okay.
I could take a photo of my desk. Both my computer desktop on the screen and my actual desk are both pretty messy. But basically, I do keep folders on my computer desktop, and I try to organize stuff with folders. So I put everything for 1935 in a folder, and then within 1935, I put everything having to do with Germany, and then within that, there might be some subfolders. And so I just use the sort of folder icons on the computer.
Well, that doesn't sound chaotic. That sounds very organized.
I would say so.
An idealized version that's what I try to do. But then I wind up with folders I can't remember what they were, and duplicate folders, and all kinds of stuff.
Wouldn't it be cool if there was a piece of software, and there probably is, that you could like cross-reference?
I think there is software. And yeah. I think before a next book project, I'd probably better learn to the downside of it is I waste a lot of time because I am.
Yeah. But you probably find other details while you're looking for that.
Well, that's true. I do. And sometimes they're really useful details.
Right.
Other times I go astray and I'll spend several days looking into something that I shouldn't be by. I just get interested in it. It doesn't really have anything to do with the book. So.
Well, Daniel, we are out of time, but this is, I really highly recommend this book.
Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely.
You know, I read the young reader's version. I think the adult version would probably be even more fascinating for someone of my advanced age.
Oh, come on.
So thank you so much for being with us today.
All right. Thanks so much for having me.
And, Mom, do you have some closing words for us?
I do. The life you live affirms the conduct you endorse. Remember, your integrity is easier to retain than to recover.
Mm. That is wise words. So stay tuned now if you're listening to us on Friday for James Moore with Planet Earthwild. And don't forget, we have the rebroadcast Monday morning if you're listening on Friday.
Yes, tell all your friends.
Yeah, and check out this book, The Boys in the Boat by Daniel James Brown. See you next week on Writer's Voices. Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline is a production of KRUU LP 100.1 FM, produced by Monica Hadley and James Moore. Archives available on KRUUFM.com and writersvoices.com.